as you said, I was reflecting, actually, I think the first time I ever set foot on an aeroplane was in 1980, also from flying from London to Stuttgart. As Volker said at the very start of my career, I had a DAAD stipendium, and so some of what I'm going to describe, I think, probably started in my own mind, I suppose, then. This is a conference about research, but of course, you know, the best research and the best pedagogy, you know, go together. And so I thought I'd begin with a couple of slides from the textbook that I've co-authored with Mike Goodchild, David Ryan and David Maguire in four English language editions since 2001. And the first slide, in actual fact, hasn't survived the transitions between different versions of PowerPoint terribly well, but it makes the point about representation. You know, so representation is as important about what we put into a representation as what we take out. You know, the world is of seeming infinite complexity, and the way that we choose to represent it, not just through geographic information systems, but also through books, through photographs, through sound, and so forth, is inevitably a selective and partial representation of the world. And this slide never made it beyond the first edition of the textbook, in actual fact, but it's trying to show something akin to a Hegerstrand time-space prism, where we have time extruded in the third dimension and space across the base of the map. And it's showing the life trajectories of three individuals. And as geographers, in many respects, we're as interested in what's left out of that representation as what's put in it. And so representations are built to express ideas in robust and transparent ways. And in the period that I've worked in geography, of course, digital media have come to triumph over all others as the ways for building representations and exchanging information. That's a slide from the chapter on representation in the textbook. This is a slide from one on the nature of geographic data. And this actually sort of portrays something which has changed quite profoundly, you know, over, you know, the 37 years since I first came to this part of the world. A generation ago, sort of our students were schooled in the linear project research design, where within the social sciences, you'd identify a problem, you'd devise a way of drawing a sample, you would collect the data, usually yourself, you would check that the data, the response rates, were uniform across the sample that you recorded. If not, you'd take some action to remedy that. And then you'd try and infer from the sample to the population that it represents. And then you'd write your report, it'd get stuck on a shelf, and that would be the end of it. And of course, that world has profoundly changed with the advent of the internet, the advent of clearinghouses, the advent of big data downloads. Today's students overwhelmingly download data, whether or not they are, you know, sort of in Volker's space of, you know, sort of remote sensing applications, or whether they're in the social sciences. And so, if we think of representation as extending our own direct experience of the world, limited to the places and the people that we interact with during the lifespan of a single human being, to indirect or remote sensing, the remit of remote sensing has become increasingly opaque as sample design has faded into the background, and there's been a loosening of control that many social scientists have on the data that they work with. And in other respects, I think, you know, so we might be critical of the achievements of the big data age. You know, sort of And what this what this slide shows is this map actually popped up in the third edition of the textbook, and what it shows here is the 12-kilometre road distance that joins the very rough neighbourhood of the Calton in central Glasgow to the affluent suburb of Lenzie in the periphery of the city. And what you can see overlain on it is a so-called geodemographic classification, a distillation of 50 or so variables that we boiled together for the UK Office for National Statistics to produce some kind of idea of sort of the lifestyles that characterise these areas. And why we've picked this up in 2009, why the book picks this up, is in a 2009 World Health Organisation report chaired by Sir Michael Marmot from University College London. He identified that life expectancy here is approximately 58 years, and life expectancy here is about 84 years. And so that 12-kilometre car journey separates a greater difference in life expectancy than separates India from the United States. Okay, and in part, that's a characteristic. That's a problem in geographic information science. It's an issue. The issues of spatial heterogeneity. Sort of bigger areas tend to be more heterogeneous in outcomes than say smaller areas. But the problem in medical geography or geographies of illness and well-being, as I believe it now is here in Germany, is after so many years and so many data sources, we can identify the pattern associated with differing outcomes, but not the process. Not the process, which is a bit like saying, I wish I knew where I was going to die. Why do you want to know that? Well, I wouldn't go there. It clearly doesn't work. And these sorts of maps of outcomes don't really tell us much about the process. And the motivation for the world in motion and big data is surely to use the richness of representation that we can now create to bring focus to dynamics as well as statics. And in other respects, I put this up, this isn't from the textbook, but it has resonance to sort of events in this country about a week ago. In 1992, opinion pollsters got the result of the British election wrong. They were all using standard, tried and tested research methods, and they all got it wrong. They knew they had to do better. But if you fast forward to 2015, they were all using different methods, different channels, more nuanced questions, different survey methods, and they all got it wrong again. And so there's a sense here almost of the receding horizon that we're building richer representations of the world, but what are they actually achieving? Our ability to predict is seemingly worse than it's ever been. So, and that really sort of sets some of the context to the advent of big data. And in other respects, the picture's even worse, because if we actually look at the kinds of conventional social science research practices that I was describing that characterised a generation ago about identifying your target population, your sample frame, drawing a systematic sample from the frame, etc., etc., those are tried and tested methodologies, but the same sort of technologies that are leading to big data are also creating respondent fatigue. And we've known now, this is taken from the third edition of the book, for well over 10 years, that the response rates to conventional social survey, conventional social surveys are falling, and in some cases falling precipitously, particularly when we try to measure the world in motion by returning to the same individuals to see how they feel, how their lives have changed. And so there's an emerging crisis in social science that conventional methods, they're not being taught, but they're not working anyway. And so we have no alternative, really, than to turn to big data, because we've got to we've got to fill the gap that's left by these plummeting response rates. But, again, the picture isn't all that pretty. So what's this a map of? Well, you can say this is an old map of geo-referenced tweets, okay? A generation ago, lots of researchers did fairly boring handle-turning research using census data. Now they tend to do, myself included, rather boring handle-turning research using Twitter data because it's got an open API, you can get hold of it and you can use it. But in methodological terms, in research terms, what is that? What does it show? Well, it's the world in motion. These are mobile consumers of a social media service. You can see that Germans are less keen on the medium than Italians, or British people. You can pick up transport arteries to say that people tweet, while they're on the road or on trains or whatever. And it's very precise. There's high apparent precision in the representation of the locations of and the timestamps at which people tweet. But what does it really tell us? And possibly the only conclusion that you can draw is, it's the geography of narcissism. It's the geography of people who, okay, look at me, I'm so groovy, if you like. It's not representative of any clearly defined population. And even when we try and infer population characteristics, this is some work I did with my colleague Guy Lansley, and what we've done here, using some methods that will become apparent, is we've tried to infer the age pyramid. This is a classic age pyramid, okay, here, with years, males and females, we've compared our modelled profiles of the age pyramids of people at the Arsenal football ground, the O2 arena, the London's second sort of business district, Canary Wharf, and one of the big shopping malls in London. And there's nothing terribly surprising sort of comes out of it. But we've tried to compare it with the age pyramid of the nighttime resident population of Greater London. But is that the right population to compare it to? What are we trying to measure? When we come to sort of measure the world in motion, a lot of the old certainties ebb away. What is the population from which this self-selecting sample is drawn? So high spatial and temporal granularity, but we don't really know what we're looking at. So we need big data. What sorts of big data do we need and how do we deal with them? Well, the approach of the Consumer Data Research Centre, which I lead in London, is to accept the reality that more and more data are collected about us as citizens, and an increasing real share of those data relate to the sorts of things that are in our wallet or on our phones. Consumer data account for an increasing real share of the data that are collected about us as citizens. And for a number of years now, we've tried to build up relations with the private sector. And people say, oh, how do you get private sector to give you data? I think our own experience would be that it's actually extremely hard. Over the last years, these are some of the UK brands and companies that have collaborated with us, often on single master's projects, giving us data relating to store loyalty cards or other consumer transactions. And some of which have moved up our ladder of engagement. They started supporting an MSc project, then they've supported a PhD, then they've supported, then they've provided a nationwide data set, and so on and so forth. And these data are extremely useful. Extremely useful because they do tell us what's going on, and as I've already implied, the time stamping of data allow us to monitor the sorts of things that Volker was talking about in his introduction, the 24-hour city, sort of activity patterns. And because our focus here is also upon the individuals, a lot of the smart cities discourse, to be quite honest, is good at monitoring the Internet of Things, vehicle movements and so forth. But vehicle movements are not the same thing as travel problems, because travel problems affect people, and vehicle movements are about infrastructure. And so an additional advantage of using consumer data is it helps us begin to shade away from this second birth of naive empiricism in quantitative social science. The objective is to focus upon the time and motion of individual citizens, and the objective is to say things are actually interesting and useful, rather than just predicting that New Year's Eve is going to fall on December the 31st, or that people in hotels don't like waiting long times for lifts and things like that, which is a lot of the more naive data empiricism. And to do that, I say, social science methods are changing. Also, the ways that we access data have to change. And so this is our secure data centre. You won't find it on the map of the UCL estate because its location isn't described and it has no connections to the external world. And organisations, including the Metropolitan Police, cognizant of the concerns that Volker talked about in about access and privacy, won't let data be used outside secure environments. And so that's one of the solutions. Other organisations that we work with use virtual microdata laboratories where I make my model prediction, they tell me how right it is. They don't let me actually access the data. They run the model remotely, or VPNs in order to access data remotely, but not on your hard disk, just in case you leave it on a train and so forth. So big data is also about new methods of access and new methods of control in order to maintain data security and ethical integrity. But for all of this, a generation ago, we didn't know a lot about people, but what we did know was about all of them. So just as a satellite image may have complete coverage of part of the surface of the Earth, the census at least attempted to get complete coverage of the population. And yes, okay, we can quibble, in Westminster in London or areas of Berlin in Germany, the coverage perhaps wasn't what people thought it was. But there was some kind of spatial data infrastructure. But none of the organisations that we work with, of course, have a monopoly of provision. If you work with one grocery retailer to identify, if we talk about health and well-being, you talk about local diet, the composition of local diet in different parts of the country, you have to accommodate the fact that that retailer may be upmarket or downmarket or in between market and so forth. And so the questions really are, how do you accommodate the sources and operation of bias in these very rich representations of the world, which are not only unknown by us, but they're unknown by the people who collect the data. And so this is really another sort of dimension that there is no spatial data infrastructure. And a lot of the old certainties that we were concerned with, sort of private versus public sector, are now blurring. In Britain, you can undertake a railway journey on track that is owned and maintained by the public sector in a train carriage, which is leased by a private company, and then transfer onto a train where the track is maintained by a private sector company and the carriage is actually owned by the state. What difference does that make? These old sort of blurring of boundaries, these old certainties are being removed. But in terms of spatial data infrastructure, what is an important context is we need to have some way of comparing data, and we need data to be open wherever possible. And that raises huge issues about, okay, you know, as academics, we all want all data to be open. We all want to live in peace, love, and happiness. You know, but who's going to pay? Who's going to pay? And that raises still more challenges, you know, to understanding spatial data infrastructure, because open platforms clearly have value, but no one wants to pay for them. So here's an example that illustrates one of the cases where it works from our research. So as one, on one of our research projects, we've got, we now have getting on for 1,000 of these sensors, we call them smart street sensors, which pick up Wi-Fi probes from smartphones, okay? And so you can see here, this is just south of UCL, University College London, where I work. And so these three sensors, you know, typically located in shop windows, are picking up this trajectory of footfall. And this in itself is a gross simplification. You know, sort of basically, you know, big data are very messy. And so actually getting these profiles is something of an achievement and an hour-long talk in itself. But in terms of platforms, you see that these three sensors are located just north of Holborn Underground Station. And you know, Transport for London, you know, publicly owned and, you know, sort of interested in getting people to build apps, you know, sort of based on data that they release data. And so it becomes possible to locate, you know, to compare the flows of pedestrians picked up here over time, okay, with people coming out of and going into the tube station. And so in terms of the world in motion, this helps us to move beyond thinking about urban form just as a geography of nighttime residence, which was the geography of the census, you know, sort of in 2011, I think in Germany as well as the UK. But it enables us to think much more of the city as a nexus of flows of people and flows of activities. And so basically the picture that emerges is that if we can gain access to private sector data, if we can, you know, sort of not worry about who owns what and, you know, sort of get access in ways that, you know, sort of is reasonable for all, we can begin to tackle these fundamental problems that big data are exhaust. They're not created for our edification as researchers. We're not important. You know, the Twitter data are a byproduct of users using the service. You know, the consumer data relating to the store loyalty cards in my wallet are a byproduct of the tactical and strategic marketing activities of the company. And they're not created for the edification of academics. But, you know, we're all recyclers now. You know, if we can recycle this digital exhaust, we can build generalizable representations that relate to populations at large. And I'll try and give, you know, say some examples of that by linking them to such framework data and open platforms as exist. And our approach here has really been about, you know, sort of building commonalities of interest. You know, the private sector, of course, are much more concerned with the next quarter's profits than the sorts of things that we're interested in. Lots of British geographers are still incredibly excited about the 2011 census that to the retail sector is half a lifetime ago. But there's shared interest in saying, you know, of what are these data representative, you know, going back to the initial points about representation. Okay, and this is one example. This is one of our postgraduates' data. These are a small subset of store loyalty card data, you know, basically saying things like, you know, this person lives here, but the shops that they go to are all around here. Well, it's clearly wrong. You know, sort of, you know, you don't live in Scotland and patronise, you know, six stores in Greater London. You know, the address data are wrong. And so this is an example where geographic analysis of activity patterns and the time stamping, the geotemporal time stamping of data allows to clean up data, which is of interest to the people that created the data, as well as to us. Why is it interesting to us? Well, because a range of different timescales, you know, we go back to the sort of Hagerstrand time-space prism, we're interested in the world in motion. We're interested in representing the dynamics of human activities in the short term, human mobility in the medium term, and human life chances over the long term, real pressing problems, and actually getting some kind of handle on them using big data. And so deliberately here, there's no time on the clock, because as the examples that I'll show, you know, sort of the clock can be calibrated in seconds, minutes, hours, years, decades, or generations. And surprisingly, consumer data unlock insights, I think, at a number of the, at all of these scales. So this is another of our projects. Basically, what you have here is energy use at half-hourly intervals, okay? And this is the city of Bristol in the west of the UK. One of our researchers, Anastasia Ushakova, has done is basically clustered the time profiles. And so, you build up patterns of people who, sort of use heating early in the morning and then when they get back in the evening, and people who just, presumably get out of bed, take a cold shower, rub grit in their hair for breakfast, go out, and only switch on the heating in the evening. And that's interesting as an analytical exercise, but in terms of activities, it's interesting because, of course, when it's cold, somebody who only needs to use this amount of heating isn't going to leave it on like this person. And so we actually build up pictures of the extent to which the residents of neighbourhoods and communities are sedentary or they're out and about. And this actually sort of begins to encourage views of hardship and deprivation in terms of activity patterns. That's to say, we're thinking about deprivation as a dynamic process, not a static state. We're not just saying, here is where poor physical and social conditions interact. We're actually saying, these people are out and about, and these people are not. And that's really, what, from a different perspective, what this is showing. Okay? And so we're building a whole series of alternative representations and synthetically bringing them together to devise small area pictures of the activity patterns that associated with different types of neighbourhoods at the diurnal, the hour by hour scale in towns and cities, and so, and then Volcker's example of traffic management or whatever comes into play. If individuals can't move about, why can't they move about? You can begin to ask those sorts of questions. This is exploratory, and this is not as good as it looks, and doesn't even look terribly good. But what this is doing is saying what we're trying to do is build together consumer registers of every consenting adult in the country whose name and address has been recorded by either on the public version of the electoral roll or by different. By different data gatherers in the private sector. So again, part public, part private sector data. And so what we're doing here, for the first time, undergraduates are taught about filtering theory, residential differentiation, the way that individuals and households move within housing markets. Ideas that go back to Chicago urban ecology of the 1920s and 1930s, but largely not verified in empirical terms. And so what we're seeking to do is create a framework whereby over a quarter of a century, you can see how Paul Longley and others like him has moved within the housing market and what his generational life chances were. okay? You know, sort of, and whether he's moved up market, down market, what processes of household formation and dissolution he's been associated with. So that's at the sort of within generation scale. This is at a still greater scale, and I've only shown this slide there once before, and nobody could really work it out. But what you've got here, across the bottom, you've got the physical and social conditions of every small area in the UK ranked from the poshest here, the wealthiest, to the least wealthy. Okay, I think it's that way around. I'll be able to tell you when I give you the results. Okay, and so this is the most wealthy down to the least wealthy. I think it's that way around. So one variable has been displayed here. There's about 1,000 individuals coded blue and 1,000 individuals coded red. And these individuals are overwhelmingly associated with high-income neighbourhoods. I think these are high-income neighbourhoods. And these individuals are overwhelmingly associated with low-income neighbourhoods. Would anyone like to take a punt what the variable is? I don't think you get it. Okay? It's their name. Okay? And so, in Britain, names came into common parlance between the 12th and the 14th century. Okay? And many of them were geographically localised. Many of them were geographically localised. Smith isn't geographically localised. I know no more about Smiths in Britain than I do about Schmidts in Germany. But many names were very, very localised. And these people, yes, this is the rich end of the spectrum. These people with this name now overwhelmingly live in upscale neighbourhoods. And these people, overwhelmingly with a different name, overwhelmingly live in low-scale neighbourhoods. And you couldn't bring that to light without consumer data. Okay, basically, you know, sort of got individual-level data. I've identified the physical and social conditions in which each bearer of those two names happens to exist. Quite astonishing. So how does that happen? Well, how does that happen? To look at how it happens, you don't have to be a quantitative geographer, you don't have to be a big data analyst in the traditional sense, but you can take, and you don't have to be a geographer. And to illustrate the point, if you travel about 800 kilometres from Tübingen, you get to the small French hamlet of Bazalgette, Bazalgette, okay? And why have I alighted on this example? Well, I've alighted on this example because it's a very small place, and only one family ever took the name Bazalgette as its surname, okay? And the head of that family moved to London at the end of the 18th century. It was a tailor, okay? And so what we can do is we can trace, you know, the evolution, you know, the Bazalgettes, what they've done. Okay, and it's, as an example, it's an example which is actually cribbed from the work of two social historians, one at the London School of Economics, Neil Cummins, the other Greg Clark, I think of Scottish origins and now working at in the University of California system. And so if you take the Bazalgettes, by 1859, I think it is, you know, the London sewage system was falling apart. There was a series of public health disasters culminating in the so-called Great Stink of 1859. And this man, descendant of the original family that moved to London as tailors, is Sir Joseph Bazalgette. And this is his cathedral, if you like. It's a sewage station in the East End of London, which is occasionally open to the public. It was open a couple of weekends ago, in actual fact. And is still used today when there are storm surges and London's sewerage system comes under constraint. And so this is clearly a family. You can trace the original person who moved. You can identify that one of its name bearers did great service to the to Great Britain and was rewarded with a knighthood. And then you can do internet searches on the name and see whether anyone else called Bazalgette pops up, and quite a lot do. Peter Bazalgette introduced the reality TV to Britain, Big Brother, an unkind commentator actually sort of pointed out that whereas this man's great grandfather dedicated his life to pumping crap out of British people's homes, his great grandson succeeded in pumping it back in again. This is another Bazalgette, Edward Bazalgette, who had a 1980s career as a member of the Vapors punk pop group, and is now a producer with the BBC. Producer, I don't know if any of you watched the costume drama Poldark, is the producer of that. And this is Simon Bazalgette, who's head of the Jockey Club, the most powerful man in the horse racing industry in Great Britain. So they've done all right for themselves. And if you look at our consumer registers, the same sort of analysis that we did of postcodes, and I've anonymised them here, all of the bearers of the name Bazalgette, pretty many, much all of them, live in very upmarket locations. So what conclusions do you draw from this? Well, I mentioned the work of Clark and Cummings a few moments ago. And they come up, they're social historians, not interested in space as such, but they come up with the astonishing conclusion. They analyse rare names which appear on the Oxford and Cambridge University rolls between the 13th and the 15th centuries. They look at rare names that don't appear on those registers, and they do a kind of big data analysis. Very innovative, very interesting. And they come up with the conclusion that those that went to Oxford and Cambridge are immeasurably more wealthy in terms of the estates that they leave than those that didn't. And so they come up with the conclusion, social status is more directly inherited than height as a characteristic. But of course, as geographers, you'd think there's something else to this, because it may well be that the Bazalgettes are superhuman, they will always triumph in career and opportunity terms. But for other people, the Offers and the Walcotts that I showed in the previous slide, it surely can't be like that. Just intuitively, we can't believe that everyone called Offer is a human survival machine, and that everyone that's called Walcott is a human disaster area. It must have something to do with economic opportunity and place. That would be the geographer's response. So that really leads us to trying to look at the association between names and places. And so a little bit of analysis. I primed our chairman, he doesn't know anyone in South Africa and he doesn't know anyone in Chile. The exceptions always prove the rule. But what we've become interested in is looking at names not like Hochschild, names related more to the isolated state of Great Britain, if you like, which is more contained in terms of the life chances and outcomes of the bearers of different names. So here's a couple of candidates. So if we look at using the 1881 census of the geography of Prime Minister Tony Blair's ancestors, you can see that this is a very regional name. And if you look at the 1881 geography of Margaret Thatcher's ancestors, You see that they are not only regionally different, but confined to entirely different parts of the country. And based on maps like this, of course, so we can look at the life chances that are on offer in these different areas and begin to piece together in a big data analysis way the life histories, the event histories of bearers of those names. And if we crank forward from our from 1881 to our consumer registers for today, and I've just done it for the late Mrs. Thatcher, you can see that the names have spread out, and that's because it's a choropleth representation. It's not particularly clear, it doesn't offer any immediate hypotheses as to what's going on. This one of former president of the Royal Geographical Society, Michael Palin, and sometime member of Monty Python's Flying Circus, for the older members of the audience, shows the pattern a bit more clearly. And so here, rather than a choropleth mapping, we've done a kernel density estimate that encloses 95% of the bearers of the name Palin in 1881, which is this one, and the turn of millennium, which is this one. And yeah, there are some margins of errors. But you can clearly see from this, the classic geographic processes of contagious diffusion, people marrying the girl down the road and taking the name and the name sort of spreading out, but also hierarchical diffusion. People are moving from here, bang, to the biggest city, and to the next biggest city and the next biggest city. And so what we're looking at there in slow motion, in an intergenerational sense, is the dual geographic processes of hierarchical and contagious diffusion. We can also, while we're talking about Blair, when I showed you Blair and Thatcher, when I showed you the model tweets in the shopping centre and the Emirates Stadium and Canary Wharf and so forth, how did we model those ages? Well, basically using consumer data for credit card applications, we can work out the age distribution of people called Tony and the age distribution of people called Margaret. Okay, so when you came to a talk by Paul Longley this afternoon, you knew he wasn't in the first flush of youth because the name Paul hasn't been in the top 50 British names for the last 20 years. Okay, and so a name is a statement of our ages, just as a surname is very often a statement of our geographic identity. But that's actually another story. You also, when you came here, the name Paul Longley, you weren't expecting somebody who's Chinese. You shouldn't have been expecting anyone of Caribbean origin, because although many Caribbeans took the names of their slave masters, there wasn't a slave owner, as far as I'm aware, called Longley. So it's not a Caribbean name or West Indian name. And so, now again, using big data analysis, we can build classifications so that if you have a name like Mohammed Gill, you can work out the probabilities that that individual would describe themselves as Indian, Pakistani, or other Asian. And so what does that do? So what we're building together then is a picture not just of geographic identity, but we're picking up a picture of self-assigned ethnic identity. And what does that allow us to do? Well, it allows us, in a boring sense, to replicate the census. So the map on the left, Britain isn't as hung up, I think, about questions of sort of ethnicity in public surveys as many European countries. And so here, there's a question in the UK census, do you consider yourself to be a Bangladeshi origin? And this is the geographic distribution. And what we've done here, for approximately the same time from our consumer registers, we've run our classification of names through. And, my eyesight's terrible these days, but I think that looks pretty much like that. The model works. And you can also crank it forward, of course, because although the census occurs only 10 years, I'm collecting consumer names and addresses in real time. Okay, and so I can produce the map of Bangladesh's in 2012, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17. Also, you know, when we have unhelpful categories or categories that are not fit for our particular purpose, such as, you know, white other, let's say I'm interested in, you know, the geographic settlement pattern of people of Greek origin in England, as opposed to you know, the white other category. Well, of course, the Greeks have distinctive names. And so, so the reason that these maps are different is that this one is, you know, is picking up a much more urban and distinctive characteristic of people of Greek origins in England than the omnipresent white category. So that's for individual names. So we've moved between an individual family, the Bazalgettes, to the bearers of much more common names, you know, sort of much more frequent names. And so what about the coincidence of names then? Okay, so we know the distribution of Blairs and Thatchers is different, but there will surely be other names, people who lived in proximity to the Blairs, that have names that are also different to people who live in geographic proximity to the Thatchers. And so this is taken from the work of my colleague James Cheshire, and Jens Kant, who supplied some of the later slides, has done a lot of work on this as well. And so this is really looking at the concept of co-ancestry, which owes quite a lot of its, you know, sort of statistical origins to the evolutionary biologist Charles Darwin's cousin, who himself married his own cousin. And he was interested in the concept of isonomy, the probability that you will marry somebody who has the same surname as you. And the concepts of isonomy and co-ancestry basically mix together so that you end up with this kind of cluster analysis, which splits different parts of the country off based on different surname structures, okay? And so Scotland goes first, you know, sort of then Wales goes, then this area, and so on and so forth. And you can do it in the context of, you know, Great Britain. This is, again, it looks a bit better than it is because it's sort of fairly early in exploratory work, but it attempts to look at it for 15, I think, European countries. You know, sort of, you know, what are the greatest dissimilarities in naming structure? And you could always see who was going to leave first, couldn't you, really, from that? But you can go down different levels of the hierarchy to see the extent to which social structures are embedded in geographic structures, you know, through names analysis. And so what you can do from that is compare the results with official zones. You know, these are, you know, Britain's government office regions. Okay, from this website, how do they compare with clusters, if you like, of regional surnames? Well, this one, of course, is different because urban areas have different surname structures, so they come out at a very early stage. But you get, you know, broad correspondence, and the advantage of the surnames analysis is you're not constrained to have precisely the same number of zones, but you can, you know, sort of have any convenient number of zones to match an administrative geography, or look at partitioning, for example, within it, okay, to look at issues of regional integrity in what is a natural zoning scheme. And you can also, you know, begin to try and look at the stability of regions. You know, you can look at, you know, how patterns of regional integrity vary over historic or more recent recent time periods. And this this map again sort of comes from work that Jens Kant did on one of our projects with the Oxford Genetics Group. The people of the British Isles project took DNA samples from volunteers who could each trace all of their grandparents to the immediate non-urban locality, and who, by inference, therefore had probably lived there for 700 years, okay? And again, a big data clustering created this regionalization of the geography of DNA of the long settled population of the British Isles. And of course, what we can do then is compare regionalisations of the country, which arise out of everybody's name versus those that have been settled there for many generations. And I think this is important because I mentioned, ethnicity is personal data. It's more than personal data. It's sensitive personal data. But we can. What is ethnicity measuring? Most obviously, sort of the characteristics of one of the organs of the body, the skin, in terms of skin colour. But based from this, what really sort of emerges is a different way of thinking about populations in terms of settled history. And so, to what extent is the population of an area very long settled, and how is it variegated, and how is it differentiated over any convenient time period? So we might pick up, the proportion of names recently arrived post-EU enlargement, for example, or we might look at the distribution of names following a wave of immigration from new Commonwealth countries and so on and so forth. And so just as I compared the Wisbeches and the Offers a few moments ago, this also allows us to see how different ethnic minorities are doing. Okay, so this is, I think this is a Pakistani name, and in same scaling as before, they're overwhelmingly concentrated in deprived areas of the country. This is an Indian name, and they're doing rather well, certainly rather better, the difference in mean residential characteristics is different. And so this sort of analysis allows us to provide dynamic indicators of cultural assimilation. And it also allows us to differentiate not only migrants within blanket categories. Somali immigrants to Britain present different issues to Ghanaian immigrants in Britain. But it also allows us to differentiate potentially within groups, just as we were looking at spatial heterogeneity in Glasgow at the beginning. So India's a big country. Its residents enjoy very different circumstances and qualities of life. And what the characteristics of immigrants taken from sort of that sample frame, if you like. So I'm really up on time now, but I think the message I want to get across in terms of the life and motion of socioeconomic units, population, the world in motion, population, is that it's very difficult to imagine a future for social science, I think, without big data. And I think consumer data the richest and the most as yet untapped source, which allow us to look at issues such as hardship, as dynamic processes in the short term, generational life chances over the medium term, and issues of social mobility over much longer time periods. And big data analysis does create genuine insights into these problems. And so hopefully then we go back to this student textbook example, and we're creating a framework that will begin to which will actually unpick the practical problem of what causes that scale of inequality over that smaller space. So I think that's all I want to say. Thank you very much for your attention.
We would like to open the discussion. Are there any questions so far to Professor Longley? Who would like to start?
Thanks for the great presentation. My name is Monica Kuffer. I'm from the University of Twente in the Netherlands. I was puzzled by one of the slides you showed about showing the different time spans when people came, foreign names came into the UK. And I was puzzled because you use very different time spans and you show in a way like a density map. And is it not to be a bit provocative cheating with maps, because you show it seems that in the latest years there's much less people coming with foreign names into the UK compared to earlier period. Shouldn't it be the same time scale you use for the maps? The same time scale that you have always, like 5 years, where you look into the people coming with foreign names into the UK, because I'm wondering how comparable are these maps?
Yes, I think the issue really comes back to the appropriate time interval. And I think, I think in terms of the baselines, I think one of the points is that big data analysis, we think of it as new and to do with present day data, but actually historical geography is all about big data analysis. The social historians analysis that I described is very much related. It's very much about historic big data analysis. The advantage, I think, yes, I mean, some of the, inevitably, some of the patterns that you reveal as you create continuous updates, may be more apparent than real. I think that, of course, that is a valid point. But I think I'd go back to the point about robust and transparent digital representations of what's going on. And you can pick the interval to suit the purpose. I think that would be my response. And so all I would say is that, I think it's a robust and transparent analysis. If you want to change it, yes, you can change the time frame, you can change the scale. On those maps, the intervals and so forth vary, in order to produce a pattern. But yes, it's classic cartography. The intervals very much determine the way that the human interprets the results.
Other questions? Yes. Thank you very much. Very interesting approach you have with those surnames. Can you first elaborate what the sources are for 1881? I think it's not data. And second, the approach you showed us works for Great Britain, because I guess there is a certain social structure in this data set. Does it also work for different countries?
Right, yeah. The second question I don't know. Should perhaps come back to. The first question is... it really relates to the Church of the Latter-day Saints, the Mormon Church. Digitized the 1881 British Census of Population, and they digitized it to high standards. Since then, my understanding is now, I think you can now get 1881, 1891, 1901, and 1911. Census data in digital form. And so what that also, interestingly, sort of opens up is as the census has cranked forward, so more questions were asked. And so I think another very interesting question to address is when you look at the way that different cities have fared over time, have they done that on the back of recent migrants, or have they done it from within their own resources? And so I think in terms of industrial geography, we traditionally sort of think of the firm as the unit of analysis, the actor, if you like. And there's all sorts of problems in doing that when you actually look at I don't know, you look at, you know, the geography of patents filed, you know, sort of, you know, to try to identify whether regionally based firms innovate and so forth. But there's all sorts of measurement issues about where patents are filed for and where they're not. And I think a much more interesting approach is to actually say, you know, for a given area, what percentage of the population have moved in the last 10 years. So, you know, certainly if I were sort of establishing, you know, sort of if I were establishing a footloose industry, I'd want a workforce that was adaptable, open to change, you know, not one that had been there for 120 years. I mean, that's my personal predilection, but it's something that I think we can, you know, as I say, we can rethink migration and regional settlement structure in terms of longevity, rather than, you know, sort of superficial racial characteristics, for example.
Paul, I just also would have one question to you. Mm. Well, big data, and there are also lots of indicators. So what are you doing if you would like to have, let's say, for explaining the world, if you would like another indicator where you just don't have the data so far, let's say, or georeference data where you can draw your nicely maps. So what are you doing then? So,
yeah, I think that's a very interesting question, because I think, you know, a lot of the message of big data analysis is, you know, be careful what you wish for. You know, and I think what it makes apparent is, you know, we've always used just surrogate indirect indicators when we didn't have income data. You know, we have, you know, in British terms, you'd classically, you know, use car ownership as a surrogate of income. So everyone would say, yeah, really, I want, you know, a measure of income. You know, that was the holy grail. I think what the social mobility stuff really throws up is, you know, what is an effective measure of human capital at the level of the individual, and, you know, what's a reliable indicator of social capital, you know, at the level of the, you know, at the level of the community. So I suppose really, yes, what I would like is some kind of consensual measure of human and social capital, so that we can actually begin to actually unpick these sort of, you know, wicked problems of what actually is social mobility, what is social change. Yeah.
So we are actually evaluating quite a lot of remote sensing data in that regard as well. And what we are trying is to get an indicator, let's say, from the rooftops, which we can see within the remote sensing data, in order to get there some classes of income, mm-hmm. yeah, to get some indicators for social classes, because mm-hmm. then when you are able to detect, let's say, terabytes or petabytes of urban remote sensing data, that you might be able to get an indicator on the social structure of the cities, yeah, in order to get a more proper planning for the future.
Yes, I think that's interesting. And the whole issue then is really, you know, sensitivity to context. You know, so really what we are doing is we're comparing unique places, and we're trying to answer the question, what place is like this place? And there will always be exceptions to the use of particular indicators. So, as I say, to take the example of car ownership, it clearly doesn't work in affluent, you know, downtown Berlin or downtown London or downtown Manhattan. It's an inappropriate indicator. And so I'm sure you will find, in terms of these, you know, physical indicators, they need to be made geographically contingent, because you will discover places that they don't work, and, you know, they may actually be a perverse indicator of what's going on. But I think, you know, the thrust of what we're trying to do is generate new data-rich indicators of areas and the activities that characterise them, you know, which, are, going back to what I say, are robust, transparent, open to scrutiny. You may not like them, but then you can criticise them. You know, we're a bit further forward. Yeah.
So, well, then Thanks a lot. Thanks, of course, Paul, for that nice view on big data. Also, it might be still at the moment a bit different in the UK than in Germany, if Germans are looking at big data. But that was very impressive. Thanks a lot for that.